Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli, and today is August 8th. We have returning guest Charles Hugh Smith. He's author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of several books on our economy and society, and he's also has developed a blog called oftwominds.com, one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites, and most recently, his own Substack, charleshughsmith.substack.com. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. I'm very happy to be here on an auspicious day, at least in the Chinese universe, which is a double, 8/8/24.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Great. And today we would like to focus on a very interesting topic, and that is what you call the Great Unwinding. The unwinding of 15 years of distortions and financial repression. Your thoughts initially?
Yeah, Richard, I've been writing a lot about this great unwinding on my blog because I think it's inevitable, and I'm not alone in that the distortions that were instituted after the 2008-2009 global financial crisis were at the time intended to be temporary measures in the emergency. And then they quickly became permanent policies. And then not only permanent, but they expanded. And so they've now reached levels that are destabilizing the global economy. And now that we see people, normal, regular working people suffering from high inflation and high debt loads, we see governments straining under high debt loads, we see speculative bubbles popping. All of these are the result of these massive financial repression distortions. And you have you've created a chart that really explains the process and the motivation.
Yes, and it's basically this chart here. Let me make it a bit bigger. So if you can see my screen that I'm sharing now, this is a chart that our group came up with several years ago to help explain financial repression, what it is. And essentially it starts with the goal of controlling and reducing the burden of government debt, as you can see at the top. And what happens is there are essentially good intentioned policies by governments, by central banks, fiscal authorities, all good intention to work towards that goal. And the sub-goals are in the corners here, maintaining confidence in government, minimizing the risk of financial and economic crises, maintaining economic growth, and minimizing the risk of a derivatives meltdown, right? The multi-trillion dollar derivative industry. So we have then, as you move towards the center, the four quadrants on the outside, four pillars, we call them at the bottom, is more ring fencing regulations like Basel Accord that are encouraging and forcing like the purchase of bonds by banks for covering on unexpected losses. So that's all encouraging the purchase of government debt. And then there's other areas of this, like money printing, currency depreciation. At the top, we see financially repressed interest rates, something we've been having for many years, repressed interest rates by central banks, right? Keeping interest rates very low. And then as you move towards the center, these are the four areas here, negative interest rates, inflation, ring fencing regulations, obfuscation, that are the result of those good intention policies which ultimately result in adverse risks to investors, pension funds, retirees, right? Because then you're left with lower negative yields. You know, how can you make money, right, from a saver perspective, from a pensioner perspective, if interest rates are very low? What's happened recently is that's morphed into another tool of financial oppression, which is the inflation or a loss of purchasing power. And of course, some of these result in wealth confiscation as well. So all of this is happening. As mentioned, there's no conspiracy on this. It's basically good intention policies resulting in adverse risks. Your thoughts, Charles?
Yes, Richard, thank you for the opportunity to talk to your chart. What I want to point out is these policies create winners and losers. And as you say, the losers are savers and wage earners because inflation destroys their purchasing power. And that's a form of wealth confiscation. And then it also hurts the bottom 90% because they don't own enough of the assets that are it bubbling up, you know, inflating in value because of this huge surge of zero interest rates and quantitative easing liquidity, which is available to people that already have wealth, right? They're able to borrow it and invest in speculative assets. So the bottom 90% lose out in two ways, right? Their wages are being reduced by inflation, and then they're also missing out on the wealth effect that central banks implicitly decided was the way to boost economic growth was to make everybody wealthier by asset appreciation as opposed to increasing productivity. And that's really the core issue here about the great unwinding and the financial repression is it does not support the actual expansion of prosperity because that requires putting income and assets and capital into productive growth, not speculative assets. And instead, the last 15 years, all these policies have done one thing, which is encourage speculation. And so we have this wild speculative frenzy that's really like the tulip bubble or the South Seas bubble or all the other fantastic bubbles of history, where the speculative frenzy becomes the focus of the entire society and the economy. And then, of course, all bubbles pop, and then you end up with a depression or recession. And then you have an opportunity to normalize. And so the other point I would make is in a correct policy, if you want to call it that economically, right, based on the Austrian school plus history plus common sense, whatever emergency policies were put in place at 2008, 2009, they should have been quickly normalized. Like, say, by 2011 or 12, all they should have been reduced to zero. And so instead, because that would have caused some pain to, say, the banking sector and the wealthiest individuals, then that was not done. Instead, they just did more of what was creating these distortions and choosing winners and losers. And so what we're proposing here in our discussion is the great unwinding is a positive element, even though it will cause a recession and the deflation of this enormous speculative bubble, and people will be hurt from that. We need to normalize interest rates and liquidity and the entire economy so that the true costs of borrowing are part of the discipline of deciding where to invest your capital. Whereas now we have an economy that's run by moral hazard, you know, with at zero interest rates that favors the wealthiest, then they can go and borrow huge amounts of money and then drive up speculative assets, which is why we see that housing is not affordable. And as you and I were discussing before we started recording, it's like statistically, apparently 70% of all the equity value in the global stock markets is in the U.S. market. And so that kind of preponderance is obviously it's not being driven by wise investment for productivity. It's massive speculation.
Meet the cedar owl. a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
Yeah, and of that 60%, 30% going into Mag 7 equities. So if you do the math, it's essentially 60 times 80, 18% of all global investable assets were recently going into only those Mag 7 equities, the Magnificent 7. That's what that means, Mag 7, the seven particular tech equities. NVIDIA, for example, being one of them. So it was just totally insane at 18%.
That is the kind of crazy competition for speculative assets that drives it even higher. And so that's not really productive. And so we also have to look at just in the non-speculative part of the economy, there's a lot of negative effects to this kind of financial repression we're discussing. And there's a lot of talk now about the carry trade in Japan, which, you know, very basically is just because interest rates have been suppressed to zero for 35 years in Japan, except for one brief attempt to renormalize in 2007. The Bank of Japan quickly withdrew because it crashed their stock market. Corporations and financiers can go to Japan, borrow yen very cheaply, and then convert it into assets that pay much higher interest rates. And so that is the kind of thing that is encouraged or incentivized by financial repression. But meanwhile, if you look at the Japanese economy, it's in what they call a liquidity trap, where they have kept interest rates low, zero. They keep trying to get people to borrow more money and spend it, but people aren't borrowing and spending more money, even though it's at a very low interest rate. And the reason why is they can't be sure that any speculative asset they bought won't be worth less next year, right? So that's not been a winner for Japan. I mean, Japan has just basically squandered 30 some years, lost to the downside of quantitative easing and zero interest rate policy. And if we look at China, a lot of people ask, well, how could the Fed and the European Central Bank, and how could the central banks create all this extra liquidity with quantitative easing and other policies? Normally that would create inflation, and in fact it does. It's obviously highly inflationary to just pour trillions of dollars into your financial sector. And so how was it that we enjoyed, you know, 12 to 13 years of low inflation? Well, that was because of China. Is that China entered the world economy in force after the being 2001 entry into the World Trade Organization. And as the workshop of the world, they were basically exporting deflation to the developed world, because they were lowering production costs so significantly that they were, in a sense, balancing out the inflationary pressure of financial repression with lower costs of production of real goods and services. So that whole impulse has ended now, because China has now run into the limits of its own financial repression, which is its housing sector, which was sort of the equivalent of the U.S. stock market. It was the predominant force of speculation in China, where, you know, middle-class households would buy a second or third apartment as a form of savings and speculative investing. And that's kind of run out of rope, right? That's kind of run into a brick wall. They have tens of millions of unfinished apartments. They've had so there's no more room left to expand a housing market that's already in tremendous surplus. And then they've been relying on exports. And so with global trade now being disrupted with the pandemic, and also people starting to realize that national security requires reshoring key industries, then the Chinese can't really push any more exports. And so their economy is floundering for those limitations. And so they're not able to create a credit impulse that's going to boost the whole global economy. And everyone's already sort of taken the deflationary rewards of China's industrialization. So now this is why we're seeing inflation not going away, because there's no offsetting deflationary impact like that China offered for the last 20 years. So inflation, in my view and many other people's, is here to stay. You know that it's the result of financial repression and also just disruptions in the global supply chain and other reasons. So that's why we're not going to be able to get back with the same tricks. Like, in other words, a lot of people believe that the Fed is going to drop interest rates to zero, like post haste, and along with all the other central banks. And I think that for the reasons we're discussing today, that's not going to happen. That's not, in fact, possible, because I don't think inflation is going to go down even in a recession. So I think we can talk about where do we go from here as all these policies unwind. And I'd appreciate your thoughts on that.
Yeah, exactly. It's beginning to unwind, and whether you call it catalysts or different factors, as you mentioned, you've got the carry trade even just last week, a 0.25% increase, or from 10 basis points to 25 basis points increase in Japan caused massive havoc, from the Japanese carry trade. But it's not just that. As you've explained, we've had all these factors that are propelling inflation and interest rates higher. So we're no longer in this disinflationary environment that we enjoyed from roughly 1980 to just recently, with interest rates, bond yields going lower and lower, bond prices going higher and higher. It's going to be a secular change for maybe the same length of time for inflation and interest rates going higher again, from here, from the last few years. And some of that is also due to the factors of geopolitical events that are happening. Of course, you've got concern by many of the global South or BRICS plus plus countries like China, Russia, after what's happened with confiscation of assets, freezing of assets by the West of Russia, and everybody saying, "Oh, I could be next," right? China saying, "I could be next, so why not sell or begin selling quietly my bonds while I have a chance?" And that's been happening at an accelerating pace, albeit still quiet, slow and methodical. Yeah, the China's been selling a lot of U.S. Treasury bonds. And so then the question is, it's not just China, but many other foreign buyers. Who will buy? If it's not foreign buyers? Well, one source is that they may look domestically, right? Why not change the rules on 401ks, RSPs, on the registered accounts, and force like 50% of those assets into buying government bonds to become the buyer that's missing now. So that could happen, right? And another type of financial oppression. The other thing I think you've written about also is on unregistered accounts, you may have forced taxation to 90% non-government bond type of securities like equities, for example, and maybe make government bonds, the taxes on that for distribution and capital gains to be 0%, right? To encourage more. So, both registered accounts, unregistered accounts could be changed from domestically to encourage buying. But then there'd also, at the end of the day, could be just monetization by the central banks, by the Federal Reserve, the Bank of Canada, outright monetization of the debt, if that doesn't help, or if they run out of buyers at that level. So there's still lots of tools that could happen, but in the end, when you do that, it's going to be more selling, right, by people who have equities if they have to go 50% into government bonds for registered accounts. As I mentioned, you're going to have selling of equities. Again, this could unwind many of those speculative assets. So there's momentum there. The other thing is on the need to buy the equities, or who will be buying equities, or which equities make sense, right? In terms of where this all leads to, in my opinion, these speculative assets will no longer be the asset class of choice, even if interest rates are lowered. There's talks about three cuts this year by the Federal Reserve, maybe up to five, or going into next year. But even if that happens, in my opinion, I don't think that will bolster the business models of these Mag 7 or tech stocks, which was the bubble of the last period here. Instead, I think all of these events will monetization of the debt, and inflation, right, is lowering the purchasing power of the currency. Eventually, you'll have depreciating currencies, not just the U.S. dollar, and that will likely lead to investments in assets that are productive. So there's likely to be a normalization process. And it will result, I believe, in more investments in productive assets, emerging markets, where there's a significant infrastructure investment going on, and associated hard assets, metals, not from a speculative perspective, but from actual economic activity. And so this will result in overall a normalization process. Your thoughts, Charles?
Yeah, I totally agree with that diagnosis, Richard. And I think you're right that where can we, as a global economy, where can we get the most leverage in terms of increasing prosperity from capital? And it's in the developing world where in many nations there's been low productivity in agriculture. In other words, this is like the core of human existence, right? I mean, if you can invest in getting cleaner water and a more productive agriculture that's sustainable. I mean, these are like where and low tech or appropriate tech. I mean, this is where we would really boost the lifestyle, if you will, of people and increase their security and do so and make money doing it because we're investing in productivity, right? And so I want to talk real briefly about debt because the whole thing with financial repression, ZIRP, and QE is to encourage people to borrow way more money than makes sense, right? I mean, that's really the bottom line, right? To try to encourage people to consume more based on debt. And so what's happened is now we're running into like debt saturation. In other words, the bottom 80% in America is running into credit limits. They've already maxed out their credit cards. They have a lot of student debt. They have auto loans, high mortgages, and so on. So no matter how low you push interest rates, if they're tapped out and they're not a good credit risk, they're not going to be able to borrow more money. And so that's the liquidity trap. corporations are also having to pay more money now because interest rates are going up, and they're rolling over debt that was cheaper into more expensive debt, right? So in all cases, that engine of trying to increase consumption and speculation by encouraging people to borrow more has now reversed. Now people are trying to unload debt, pay it down, because the debt service is eating them alive. So again, the governments and central banks' policy was, now that the private sector is trying to reduce their debt load, then the governments have stepped in and increased their debt-based spending, right? The governments have been borrowing trillions to fill the hole left by the private sector. But now government spending is reaching the limits that that just common sense suggests. For instance, the famous calculation that once your sovereign debt exceeds 100% of your GDP, then your productivity starts stagnating and you enter like sort of stagflation. And so the U.S. is way over 100% of its GDP, and many other nations are too. So part of the normalization is to no longer depend on debt to fuel consumption and speculation. It's more like we're going to have to cut expenses, right? And go ahead and let the bubbles pop, and then encourage saving as the form of acquiring capital the hard way, if you will, but the right way, where you save up the capital and then you invest it for return. And so that's gonna create a recession, because we've been basing our economies on I would have to say phantom wealth, which is all the money that's been borrowed to fund consumption. And then the speculative wealth effect is also phantom money, because it's not that the house that private equity bought and rented out, it's not that that increased in its utility value. It simply became a financial asset. So this normalization we're speaking about is on many levels, and it's going to require a change of values to sort of reduce the incentives for speculation and increase the incentives for productive investing. And so hopefully that's the policy that we're suggesting, because that's the policy that's going to work in the long run.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the last point we can make is how the normalization process will lead to being more fair to the majority of the people currently from the financial repression that's been going on. One example for that is the quantitative easing process. You have a situation where the central banks made funds available for the financial sector, the financial institutions, at very low interest rates, like typically, for example, 0.25%, 25 basis points. On the same day, that financial sector institution can turn around and buy bonds at 3%, 4%, making essentially free money, and then levering that up, whereas the Main Street is not able to tap into that, to get access. So it inordinately benefits the financial sector more than Main Street. And do you have other examples, Charles, that you can elaborate on how the normalization process could be more fair to the majority of the people?
Yeah, I think that's a key point, Richard. Thank you for bringing that up, that the system that's now been rigged by financial repression is incredibly unfair, and it's been driving this extreme wealth and income inequality. And so it's like, just to take a common example, it's like housing is now out of reach in North America and in many other places, Europe and China as well, that the normal working household cannot afford to buy a house. And so that is not necessarily a shortage of supply. It's all the financialization, the consequences of financial repression that have pushed these assets to the moon. So in normalizing, it would then allow it would allow the bubble to pop, and then assets such as housing could then fall to levels that would become more affordable. And so that would be a much fairer economy of the kind that we used to enjoy in, say, the 60s and 70s and even the 80s and 90s. And so we really kind of want to go back to the economy we had in 1995, if you will, which was not a bubble. It was a highly productive economy, and the growth was widespread because it was investing in productivity, not in just pure speculation. So fairness is a big reason why people are angry, you know, as they sense that the economy is no longer fair, and that they've been selected by financial repression to be the losers, and a much smaller group of people have been selected to be the winners. And so that unfairness is what erodes social, the social order and the social contract. So we're basically concluding that the great unwinding needs to happen so that we can renormalize our economy and society for the better.
Yes, absolutely. Great, great points, great insight, Charles. And that is the hope, that we get to a normalization process that is the best for all. And thank you very much for your discussion. How can listeners learn more about your work?
Yeah, welcome to visit me at oftwominds.com. Free samples of my books, free archives of my blog posts, or go to my Charles Hugh Smith Substack. Thank you very much, Richard.
Great. Thank you, Charles.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.